Secondly, continuing our study of Fromm's definition, that a ritual, rational ritual, is expressive of common strivings. Expressive of common strivings. Now let's take the last word first. Ritual expresses a striving. It's something, certainly in Buddhism, that one does oneself. It is not something which is done for you. It's not something in which one merely passively participates, much less still is it a gorgeous spectacle which one merely watches. This is, of course, the sort of understanding we've got about ritual. It's something which someone comes along, say a priest comes along, and does for you. You just sit back and watch, or you pay him to do it for you. Well, this is a degeneration. According to Fromm, and certainly according to Buddhism, ritual is something which one does for oneself, or at least does oneself. You may not do it only for yourself in the sense of for your own individual benefit alone, but it's something you do yourself. It's a matter of striving, it's a matter of exertion. In other words, ritual is part of what is called one's sadhana, one's spiritual practice or spiritual exertion. We should not think that the performance of a ritual is a substitute for spiritual striving. It's a form of it, we may say. So we may therefore also say that the ritual approach is not for the lazy man. Sometimes people talk of performance of ritual as though it's very, very easy, that it's an easy way. You don't like the hard way of religion, so you take up ritual instead as an easy, comfortable sort of substitute. But this is really not so. If one has this sort of attitude, it shows one really knows nothing about ritual from experience. To be a good ritualist is not easy. To be a good ritualist is at least as difficult as giving a lecture, or at least as difficult as meditating, if not more so. Because to be a good ritualist, quite a number of qualities are required. First of all, you have to be very mindful, because you have to do one thing after the other. You know how difficult it is, even when you take the refuges. Even though you've got me to say it first and you say it after me, I say Dhammang Saranang Gacchami or Dutiyampi, Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, and someone says Tatiyampi instead of Dutiyampi, even though it's just been said before. And why is this? It's only lack of mindfulness, that's all. No other reason. So to be a good ritualist isn't easy. You have to have your wits about you to do one thing after another in the correct order, in the correct manner, with just the right emphasis. And maybe you will have to do several things at the same time. And all this is not easy. It means a great deal of mindfulness is necessary. And then again, attention to detail. There are lots of little things that have to be attended to. Whether the water is in the bowls, whether there are three incense sticks, whether the candles are alight, whether the flowers are properly arranged. And when ritual becomes complex, you sometimes even have to have an expert just to make sure that everything is as it should be. I remember once in Kalimpong, just to digress a little bit, I had invited Danda Rinpoche to perform a rather complex ritual, and as the custom is, before his arrival all the offerings had to be kept ready on the altar. So usually this sort of thing is done by my own Tibetan students and disciples, but on this occasion they weren't satisfied with that. They did it all themselves. They laid up very elaborate offerings on many tables, lots of little lamps and lots of toramas and things of that sort. But then they said, we've called in one of the Lama Gyupas just to check it before the Rinpoche comes. So the Lama Gyupa came and he just cast his eye over all these elaborate arrangements. No, this should be there. That should be in that place. This should be the other way around. And in about 5 minutes he checked it and everything was in order. So to be a good ritualist, you also have to have the capacity to attend to detail. And again, you have to have aesthetic sense. You mustn't only just do it in the correct way, it must be beautiful, because if it isn't beautiful, it isn't inspiring. Now this is a great difference I noticed as between Hindu rituals and Buddhist rituals. The Hindus, I'm sorry to say, and this isn't a criticism, are very untidy in their rituals. They don't mind if you go into a temple or into a house where a ritual is going on, they don't mind a great deal of disorder, even dirt. I've been quite shocked sometimes going into Hindu temples and you find underfoot or decayed flowers which have been trodden for several weeks past, great heaps of them, and husks of coconuts, the kernel having been offered, but the husk is thrown down on the floor, and bits of dirty newspaper which have been used for wrapping off and just flung down anyway in front of the image, and all this rubbish lying about and no one seeming to bother to tidy it up. And even Hindus coming from a Hindu temple into a Buddhist temple are very impressed by the difference. Huh? I mean, a Buddhist temple, everything is beautifully arranged. The flowers are beautifully arranged on the altar. Everything is clean. Everything is bright. Everything is polished. And this you find not only in Tibet, not only in Ceylon, but in all Buddhist countries. They're very, very particular about this, that the ritual and all the ritual appurtenances should be aesthetically satisfying. And then again, to be a good ritualist, you also have to understand the meaning of it all. It's no use being able to do it just mechanically, go through all the right actions, unless you understand what is really going on. And this is perhaps most essential of all. And in addition, you need, I would say, to be a good ritualist, plenty of physical stamina. Because you may have to sit for hours chanting, doing this and doing that, and it takes, therefore, plenty of physical vigour to be able to do it. Usually we like to think that ritual is a sort of kindergarten stage of religion. It's for the beginners. But the Tibetans don't think that. The Tibetan tradition permits only the spiritually advanced to indulge in lengthy and complex rituals. This perhaps is news to most people. Certainly every Tibetan Buddhist has a little ritual, which he does, but it's only the Rinpoches and the more highly developed in general who are permitted to indulge in very lengthy and very complex rituals. Because ordinary people won't have the necessary mindfulness, they won't understand what they're doing, and so on. So they're not allowed to indulge in these very long and, as I said, complex rituals. I remember from my own experience seeing Dandō Rinpoche himself perform quite a number of rituals. And Dandō Rinpoche, who we'll be seeing on the slides incidentally this evening, among his other qualifications, is an excellent ritualist. He's very good at Buddhist philosophy. He's a very good organizer, runs an excellent school, and he knows much about Buddhist yoga. And he's also a very good ritualist. And I often watched him for hours on end going through certain rituals, and I sometimes wondered to myself how he was able to correlate it all. Because I would notice that he'd be chanting, maybe for half an hour or 1 hour, ringing his little bell and making offerings, and sometimes as he was chanting, got towards the end of the text, he would start folding the silken cover in which the book was wrapped in a very elaborate sort of way, in a sort of pattern. And I noticed that as the last tinkle of the bell died away, and the last word of the ritual was recited, the last flower thrown, the last grain of wine, at that very moment, the last fold of that cloth would be put in place, and it all synchronized. And he seems to do it perfectly effortlessly. He might even be looking around, even smiling, but it would all go on, almost like a piece of music, and all just end together, just at that moment, apparently without any effort at all. Because he had been trained in these things for many, many years and was, one may say, a perfect master of them. I might also add that his gestures and mudras, as those of many lamas, were very, very beautiful to watch as he made the different mudras to accompany different offerings and so on. Anyway, that is a digression. Let's get back to our main point, which is that ritual expresses a common striving. It's not only a striving, not only a form of spiritual practice, as I've tried to make clear, but it's a common striving. And this is a very important point. It implies that ritual, the performance, the practice of ritual, is possible only within a community. If you're just doing it on your own, well, it may not be exactly neurotic, but it isn't ritual in the full sense. It may be a striving, but it's not a common striving. So this common striving can take place only within a community, a spiritual community. We've already spoken of ritual as shared action, And this means not just performing, but the same actions side by side. It means giving expression through the actions to a common striving. And for this reason, a feeling of brotherhood is, as it were, essential. And we see, therefore, that ritual also implies metta, loving kindness, solidarity, and so on.